Buffalo can hang on. This is going to be a good one.
The fans at Kansas Speedway know how to have a good time. And you are all invited. NASCAR weekend at Kansas Speedway, May 4th and 5th. Get your tickets now at kansasspeedway.com.
Pack your bags, start the car, and get on the road. It's time to go across the country, 2 minutes at a time, for the biggest stories of the day, where they're happening.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Cleveland, Ohio.
Boston, Mass.
Miami, Florida.
It's the 2 minute drill on the program.
2 minute drill time here in the program. Joshua Briscoe filling in for Sarin Petro today. We'll take you to San Diego, Philly, Minnesota, and Chicago. But we'll start over on the West Coast with John Schaefer of Extra 1360. John, to start off, I mean, obviously right now, the San Diego Padres have been one of the more interesting teams in baseball. But Fernando Tatis Jr. now injured. How dire is it?
Well, it's a big blow, and first of all, thanks for having me. I mean, it's significant. He's had this shoulder recurring injury for a lot of this 2021 season, and he's been able to bounce back and not miss a fortune of time as of yet, but this could be significant. We'll see. He'll be on the IL for at least 10 days. If the situation doesn't improve, there's a scenario where they shut him down, but it's tough to bet against Fernando Tatis Jr., so I think a lot of people in San Diego are optimistic that he will return at some point here, whether it's in August or September.
It seemed like there was a pretty serious report, right, you know, just not too long before Max Scherzer ended up going to L.A., that the Padres were very close to acquiring him. What did you make as that was unfolding? How close were the Padres really?
Yeah, it's been a very difficult weekend, if you think about it, because you're right. I mean, the Padres, as Ken Rosenthal reported from The Athletic, I think on Thursday afternoon, were quote-unquote close to a deal with Scherzer, and then just mere hours later, he ends up with the Padres' rival, the Dodgers, and then 24 hours later, Fernando Tatis Jr. goes down to a shoulder injury. I'm not really sure how close they got. A.J. Preller, the general manager of the Padres, talked about it with the media. He said that he thought the report was just inaccurate. It wasn't up-to-date information. They had been discussing Scherzer with the Nationals, but nothing was imminent, and as it turned out, the Nationals obviously were consummating a deal with the L.A. Dodgers. So the Padres could certainly use starting pitching. They didn't add any starting pitching. And then to make matters worse, as you talked about, they've lost Fernando Tatis Jr. for the next week and a half at least. So it's a little bit of an important time in their schedule, certainly heading into the back stretch.
And then also the Eric Hosmer stuff has been very interesting to me, obviously, here from Kansas City, where we knew him and loved him well on the way to a World Series. And then he ends up going to San Diego, getting a huge bag of money. But now it seems like the Padres are very actively trying to get somebody else to pick up that extremely large bag of money.
Yeah, the question is really, can the relationship be salvaged? Because you're right. I think, publicly they had discussed options of bringing in someone to play first base, whether that be a Nelson Cruz, who's primarily a DH, a Joey Gallo, who plays a lot of outfield but can also play first base, and neither of those two deals came to fruition, and now Eric Hosmer is still here. Now, he's certainly, a professional, and his numbers in San Diego have not been as good as his numbers in Kansas City, although he has had a very good last 30 games or so. So he's going to be important. I mean, without Tatis, they'll need a player like Hosmer to step up. He's clearly not going anywhere at this point. He could move at some point in the offseason, but they need him to have a big second half if they're going to make a run in the postseason this year.
If I've got all my numbers right, he's under contract through 2025 with three $13 million player options on the last 3 years of that deal. I mean, what is the feeling in terms of what they have locked in so far with Hosmer and what he's going to look like, not just for the remainder of this season, but for the remainder of this deal, theoretically?
Yeah, I think that the desire would be to move the contract because he just really hasn't lived up to the dollar figures. Like you said, it's a $144 million deal, $39 million of which are those final 3 years. It's all player option after year five, which you would assume he'd opt into because it's hard to envision that he's going to make that type of money after 2022. So, the Padres are in a scenario where they're trying to win right now. Their payroll is significant, maybe the top, two or three right now in all of baseball. So if there's a situation or a scenario that presents itself where they can shed off that contract, maybe in the offseason, they've got another outfielder, Will Myers, who's owed $20 million next year as well. If they can move one of those two deals, I think they won't hesitate because that will give them some financial flexibility potentially for 2022 and beyond.
I did not know that Will Myers was set to make $20 million next year. You guys have a lot of money tied up in baseball over there right now.
You're not kidding. They're as close to the luxury tax threshold as any other team. There's only one team over right now. That's the LA Dodgers. I think the Padres are second right now in Major League Baseball in payroll, which is incredible because this is the 26th largest market in baseball, but they're really committed to winning. And we'll see if it plays out or not here in 2021 or the next couple of years.
Well, John, enjoy covering one of the most interesting teams in baseball, and hopefully you end up having a better Eric Hosmer report next time we chat.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
It's New York, Philly. It's just Philly here as we talk to Ayton Shander of SportsMap Radio, 1480 Fox Sports, The Gambler. Ayton, a lot going on there right now in Philadelphia. I want to start with the basketball side of things because I kind of thought Ben Simmons would be gone by now, and he's not.
Yeah, I think the prevailing wisdom here is that Daryl Morey has pretty much started at the top, asking for everybody on a team and then trying to work his way back into some middle ground. And the reality is that Daryl Morey is not pressed to make a trade for Ben Simmons right now or in the regular season. I think that there is a backup plan in place to where Morey comes back to Simmons and his camp and says, look, we can't get this thing going at the start of the season, so you're going to have to be here either for the year or until the trade deadline. And I think that's what we've been seeing behind the scenes, but a lot of the reporting is basically like, oh, they're going to trade Simmons. They are, but I think that this is not a guy in Morey who's pressed. This is going to be his first major move, and it's calculated. He wants to get it right. Doesn't mean he's going to get it right, but he's trying to, and that's why I don't think we're going to see it rush.
It's so bizarre because, I mean, right now, this is probably the lowest Ben Simmons' value has been in his time in the NBA, maybe, or at least in a while. So, I mean, trying to be patient there makes sense. But what do you think that the Sixers are going to wait on in terms of a return?
I think they're going to wait on two things. One, they may wait on circumstance. They may wait on a free agent signing somewhere else where a team coveted that player. They may wait on a trade that happens where Team X, it was involved and then they couldn't, and then, okay, here come the Sixers, and there's a little bit more leverage for Morey. So I think in the off season, before we get up to the regular season, he's kind of just slowly, methodically waiting for a little bit of leverage to come back. And look, that could even mean like tipping it from 70-30 in somebody else's favor to 60-40 in somebody else's favor. But I think that's what he's kind of waiting on. And then the other thing, too, is Ben Simmons has to be one of the most enigmatic individuals that we've ever seen, right, in professional sports, where this is not a guy who has potential. This is not a guy who's lazy. This is not a guy who gets hurt all the time. This is a guy who's all NBA in a lot of areas, but in one glaring area, weakness, he's barely a college player. So I think that it's also going to take teams, or Morey, I think, is waiting on teams to recognize, okay, Simmons can be a secondary piece where he's more of like a fit around as opposed to trading the build with him for him.
Should be incredibly interesting to see how that comes together. One thing that is not a current member of the Philadelphia Eagles but certainly has an impact, with Carson Wentz's injury, it seems like the conditional pick that the Eagles got in return for him is most likely going to end up falling to a second round because it was a playing time issue, and it seems like he's going to be out for a little while. Is there any sort of Carson Wentz hangover in Philly as you look at what's going on right now in Indianapolis with him?
Well, the only thing, as you mentioned, the only reason why we care is because of that draft pick. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was a general belief, look, nobody could watch Carson Wentz since he got here, especially with an injury pre-existing from college. I'm not even talking about the foot injury that came out that's pre-existing from high school, but nobody who would expect you to take them seriously about comprehension in Philadelphia could honestly walk away and say that he's not injury-prone or wasn't injury-prone. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking in hindsight as the one metric of whether or not the Eagles got it right, then yeah, they got it right. Now, I'll say this. I don't know the answer, and I honestly don't believe we will know the answer, but the Eagles were either incredibly stupid and got lucky, or they were incredibly savvy and they got ahead of something, maybe hedged a bet, if you will, and that's this foot injury. There are plenty of people that I work with, former players, they'll tell you there's no way that team, the Eagles, missed that pre-existing foot injury all the way back from high school. They just thought, no problem. If that's the case and they got rid of this kid ahead of this injury that was a ticking time bomb, beautiful move. If they missed it and they just simply traded him because neither one of the side and Wentz and the team could stand each other, well, they got lucky and they fell ass backwards into it.
What about the guy who's there now? What's the feeling on Jalen Hurts at this point going into the season as the presumed number one guy?
So I'll never answer a question with a question. This is more rhetorical. But honestly, have you or anybody else, like, is there anything concrete that we can point to that definitively says from Howie Roseman, Nick Sirianni, the team, Jalen Hurts is our guy? And beyond that, I would add this one caveat. Why are they continuing to not come out and at the very least publicly say, look, all we're doing is focusing on Hurts, Freudian slip. All we're doing is focusing on Hurts. That's all we care about right now. Aaron Rodgers, Deshaun Watson. I'm surprised Jameis Winston isn't. Everybody has been connected here to Philadelphia. So on one hand, it's like he's their quarterback, and I'm really rooting for this kid. But on the other hand, the team has yet to commit to him at all, and that's where I think it's troubling.
Do you think there's some stuff behind the scenes there where they have been in on the Deshaun Watson, Aaron Rodgers conversations? Even then, you could make him the starter until one of those guys magically shows up in town.
Yeah, so I think we all have to understand who Jeffrey Lurie is. Jeffrey Lurie is a guy who loves to brag and show off to the rest of the owners when not like, you know, Daniel Snyder, you know, signing some big contract and bragging that that guy busts on the field. But Jeffrey Lurie is trying to be a craft clone and be ahead of the game and be smarter than everybody. So he's always trying to be ahead of it. And that's where I think, yes, I have no doubt in my mind they are connected to Watson as soon as Watson would be allowed to play. Like, officially, I know he's not on the list yet, but to where there's no issue. And they would take a shot at Rodgers. They would take a shot at Kyler Murray. They would take a shot at anybody. It doesn't matter who's on their team. They drafted Hurts with Wentz still there, and right. Wentz was on the billboards outside the stadium.
And on their salary cap with a billboard size amount of money to work around. And they found a way to do it, I guess. Ayton Shander in Philly, Sports Map Radio, 1480 Fox Sports, The Gambler. Thanks for the time.
Anytime, brother. Have a great day.
I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota.
We go to Minnesota. Matthew Caller on with us right now. You can read his work on Purple Insider, Substack, purpleinsider.substack.com. Matt, boy, you've had some things to discuss, to write about, to dissect with the Vikings. I think it's pretty unique. Maybe Ron Rivera in D.C. is in a somewhat similar situation. But Mike Zimmer, as you wrote about up on the Substack, is not really pulling any punches about his frustrations with his team's vaccine hesitancy, if you will, at this point in the season.
Yeah, it's really been kind of incredible to see Mike Zimmer and how straightforward he's been about his feelings. He is not both sides this at all. He has come out and said, and just a few minutes ago, he was at the podium and reiterated that he wants all of his players to get vaccinated, and he sort of frustratedly said there are some guys who are just going to refuse. And then he even sort of accused some players of reading the wrong type of information when it comes to the vaccine. And Zimmer has done a lot to try and get players to do it. I mean, they brought in the NFL Dr. Sills, who's sort of been at the forefront of, you know, the vaccination efforts and of designing the protocols and so forth. They brought him in earlier this offseason to talk to the team. But it just seems that a few of their key players especially are not going to do it at any point. And that, I think, really worries Zimmer. I mean, this is a year that there's a lot of pressure on him. He's been around here now since 2014, and they've got one trip to the NFC Championship, and that's it. So he knows there's a lot of pressure on him. And imagine if you were to lose your starting quarterback due to close contact before a game that, you know, you could go into the playoffs or a playoff game. And I think Zimmer probably envisions that happening, and that's why he's so concerned, and that's why he's so outspoken when it comes to the vaccination.
There are a couple of quotes from that presser that you mentioned that have really stood out to me. Some of them just won't do it. Some of the things they read, as you said, are out there. It's their beliefs, whatever they've heard or read or been told. Maybe they don't believe what Dr. Sills told them either. And then from the Vikings official Twitter account, they tweeted out a clip and included the quote of, "We could put this thing to bed if we'd all do this, but it is what it is." I find it kind of interesting that the team account put it out there, just like I found it kind of interesting the Bills tweeted out Cole Beasley's press conference. What's the vibe kind of around the city and amongst most of the fans? Is it growing frustration with the guys who are, you know, causing some of these problems by not being vaccinated, or are there more fans that are saying that Zimmer's out of line there?
No, I think that the majority of the fans are on board with what Zimmer's saying, and Minnesota has been one of the best states in terms of vaccination rates in the Twin Cities. I don't have the exact numbers as of now, but I saw something like 70% of people who are adults are vaccinated now, or at least have one shot, which I think is maybe part of this too, where now the team is kind of putting it out there and fans are kind of putting it out there. Like, there's kind of all of a sudden a lot of pressure on these players who aren't going to do it. It is their choice and there are protocols in place. But I think what Zimmer said was right, that, you know, he said, look, it's going to be way more difficult. And that's just the reality. If you're not vaccinated, it's going to be more difficult on the road. It's going to be more difficult for practice and for everything else. And then there's way higher risk of you missing a game. And, I think that that's kind of where the pressure goes. Like, look, people will put their politics aside when it comes to wanting their team to win. Mm-hmm. So I think even people who have not taken it and don't want to take it probably want their starting quarterback to, because they know if he's out for any period of time, it could be problematic.
So what do you guys know about Kirk Cousins? And you've written that he's unvaccinated. The interesting thing for me, sort of from the middle of the country, Kirk Cousins is not the poster boy for unvaccinated NFL players nationally, or in my mind. I mean, I think even Josh Allen and Sam Darnold's original hesitance, I think Darnold may have gotten vaccinated since, sort of led some headlines. Obviously, Cole Beasley's been the outspoken guy. But where has Kirk Cousins fallen, and how much has or hasn't he talked about it or taken those questions during camp?
Yeah, Kirk Cousins did not want to talk about it at all. And the several times he was asked, he kept saying the same thing of, that it's his medical history and he doesn't want to, talk about that in public and so forth. And then he said, of course, it's sort of old takes exposed now, but he said he doesn't foresee it being a major issue and that he's going to be doing all the protocols and everything. But now when he does come back to practice, it will be very interesting to hear from him. But I think that Cousins is a guy who kind of lives in his own world a little bit, and he has very strong beliefs about certain things. He's very religious, and I don't personally think that those two things should go together, being anti-vaccination and being religious, but, that's kind of whatever his beliefs are, that's how he views it. And I think when Mike Zimmer is telling us there are some guys that won't do it, I think he's referring to Cousins, that he's just not ever going to. And I suspect when he comes back, what we'll hear from him is, I'm not going to talk about my medical history, and it is what it is, and so forth. And, that's his right to do that. But I also think that fans probably deserve some answers here. I mean, like, this is one of the big storylines of fans being excited to come back out to training camp, fans going to be excited to be in the stands. And the other night, they had a night practice with 4,000 fans in the stands who watched Jake Browning throw every pass and not the starting quarterback. And they paid for that, too. I mean, like, you sort of get down to that part of it also. It's like, I think that they deserve some answers for why you're choosing to do something that could sideline you, but I doubt we get any of those answers.
If not answers, and if you had to bet, do you think that this sort of up-close and personal series of issues within the facilities will move the needle at all? No pun intended, but actually a pretty good pun, moving the needle. do you think that there's any chance that anyone or any significant portion of the vax-hesitant players in the Vikings locker room change their minds on this, or do you feel like this is going to be more of a season-long battle?
Well, Mike Zimmer said that there have been players on kind of a weekly basis who have come to him and said, okay, I want to do it now, that were hesitant before. I don't think that any of the key players that we know not to be vaccinated or we suspect not to be vaccinated are going to change their mind, and I think that's why Zimmer is upset. But if you're a guy who's on the bubble and you see your coach and your team Twitter account saying things like this and putting out messages like that, I think you'd be pretty smart to go ahead and get that taken care of, because they could say all – coaches can't come out and say, look, I'm going to cut the unvaccinated guys. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about reality here, right? I mean, if you have two guys who are similar in talent and one of them is going to be available and the other one has a chance of not being available, who are you going to keep? I mean, Nate Stanley is their fourth string quarterback. Like, they're going to cut Nate Stanley, right? I mean, because he's unvaccinated and he had to sit out the other night. So, that's why they're bringing in a number of quarterbacks today. So, I think that it will be a thing that we're talking about for a long time here. I don't think it's going away. And it will be especially interesting on cutdown day to say, wow, we missed on the 53-man roster on this, that, and the other thing. And, it could be possible that the vaccination status plays a role.
Matthew Collar, thank you for joining us here from Minnesota. Good luck up there and enjoy moving the needle.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Back to the same old way.
One person still remaining in Chicago, Mark Carman. You can watch him on FanSided and hear him on WGN, see him on WGN in Chicago. Mark, again, I mean, I want to talk about football. I want to talk about the Bears. I want to go into all that, but I can't off the top because I saw a tweet yesterday that has stuck with me through 24 hours now. Imagine Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, and Javi Baez were on the same team. They'd be unstoppable. What can you do to explain to us what the Cubs just did?
So, Josh, this is a tough time in Chicago for Cubs fans. There's no doubt about it. The end, everyone knew it was coming, but it was very sudden come trade deadline. But the fact of the matter is when you look back at it, everyone, or a lot of people at least, thought the Cubs were going to become this dynasty, that they were all young, they were all under team control, and Bryant and Baez and Rizzo were going to be here until 2021. They were going to win at least 2-3 World Series, all of that. And the reality is, looking back, they were lucky to win one. They were down 3-1 in the World Series. They were down 2-1 in the NLCS. They got back to one NLCS and won one game, and then they didn't win a playoff game after 2017. So it was overdue for some massive change. Now, could they have built around, you know, one of these guys and made it a little bit more palatable for the fandom? Sure, but they could bring any of them back. I don't think they will, but that's all certainly possible at the end of the season. And I think the only real big surprise to me is that there just was no market for Chris Bryant, and the Giants got him for their 9th and 30th prospects. Good job, San Francisco.
Well, the return is one of the things that's interesting to me, because being here in Kansas City, I would love it if the team that we cover would ever trade away any of their players at anything more like peak value to build for the future and not be delusional about their window. But I digress. So what did the Cubs get in return? How well are they set up now for the next sort of phase of the rebuild?
So, I mean, Nick Madrigal's the biggest piece that will be in the lineup next year, probably leading off and definitely playing second base, because he's not going to play any other position. He's going to hit 300 and not going to strike out much. I think it's a high floor, low ceiling guy. I don't envision Nick Madrigal becoming this all-star second baseman, but certainly a quality player. And then Cody Hoyer is a decent bullpen piece too. In the Kimbrel trade for 2 months of a closer that was going to, well, he is under, you know, they have a team option for Craig Kimbrel. So the White Sox could bring him back next year for $16 million. So maybe that did give the Cubs a little bit more value. Pete Crow Armstrong is the center fielder that they got for Javi Baez from the Mets, who I think is the most next most interesting piece, at least for me. Foul line to foul line, top of the order hitter, just an absolutely absurd athlete. And when you watch his YouTube clips, which is what Cubs fans are doing right now, you see just a lot of emotion, which I think is always fun to have a player who wears his heart on his sleeve, that type of guy. So, look, the Bryant deal, strike-throwing pitcher, you know, a bat that's hitting 230 at single A, but they like, quote-unquote, like him. I mean, a lot of this is, do you believe in Jed Hoyer? And with Anthony Rizzo, they were, you know, these guys are slotted in to be in the Cubs' top 10 prospects. So, I mean, I'm not sure if that just speaks to that they absolutely ripped New York because they're willing to pay off the rest of Rizzo's salary, or is it more because the Cubs system was so thin, which makes me just wonder how in the world have you been drafting this long and yet to, you know, develop a starting pitcher in all the years that Theo and now Jed have been running the Cubs. But I think they did fine. The Bryant one is just the most disappointing.
I've learned to never trust anybody named Jed, so that's an easy one for me. What about on the other side? The Royals are going to start their series with the White Sox here tomorrow. Eloy Jimenez, they had a funeral for him. He came back. Now he's injured again. What's the state of the White Sox right now?
I mean, it's all in, right? We went out and traded our number 4 overall draft pick to get Craig Kimbrel, who we don't even necessarily need because we have one of the best closers in baseball, and Liam Hendricks. So the White Sox are all in on winning the World Series this year. And Eloy's going to be fine, and Robert's coming back. And also, you know, they've been banged up all over the place. You're going to get Yasmani Grandal back catching, which is an interesting one, too, because he's, you know, coming off a knee injury. Is he going to be able to hold up there? And their backup catchers, I mean, these are, you know, small issues. But, you know, if Grandal's not healthy, then you got Zach Collins and or Sebi Zavala. catching for you, which, you know, if you're going to nitpick the White Sox roster, that'd be where you would go. But they, listen, the bullpen is with Kopech and Kimbrel and Hendricks, you are loaded. Hopefully they'll get the lefty Aaron Bummer back going. He did pitch fine yesterday. So that's one thing, I guess, another way you can nitpick him. But the Sox are World Series or bust. They're all in, baby.
And, I mean, they've got a pretty nice cushion to get things figured out in the Central. Yep. Not a whole lot of immediate threats right behind them. So there's that. Real quick on the football side of things, what right now in training camp, looking at the quarterback battle, assuming that Justin Fields, obviously, I mean, he's the guy for the long term, is he going to be the guy for week one?
No. Andy Dalton will start, and I think he'll start for a while. You don't want to do what they did with Mitchell Trubisky, which was bring in Mike Glennon, which was maybe – Andy Dalton 1A, and now we've got, you know, 1B and Dalton, and have him play for 4 weeks and just throw him out there. Now, of course, I'm way more high on Justin Fields than I am on Mitchell Trubisky, and he's played more football than Trubisky had played coming in, you know, 1 year at North Carolina. But I don't think that there's any real rush to get him on the field, although the training camp tweets are out, and they are positive. So how long will Matt Nagy and company be able to resist the temptation to put their quarterback of the future out there? I think it's at least until, say, week 4, Lions, October. I don't think he plays, you know, any time in the first month. And I would actually, if I had to bet on it, I'd say in the second half of the season.
But that's reflective of a particular strategy, not any sort of newly lessened expectations, correct?
Correct. Expectations, huge. Quarterback, they finally figured it out. That's the narrative that you're hearing from Bears fans right now, and the Bears too, for that matter. I mean, they're not necessarily saying that, but there's a lot of excitement. So I think they feel supremely confident that they did well in the draft, trading up to get Justin Fields, who's going to take off. And honestly, the bar is not too high here. Best quarterback in the history of the franchise is within quick reach. Could have it in year two. So, I mean, we're still talking about Sid Luckman in the 40s as the greatest Bears quarterback of all time.
You can watch him on FanSided. You can hear him on WGN. Mark Carman, glad you didn't get traded. Give Matt Verderam my best at some point. Tell him that that you love Applebee's and just see what he does.
I will absolutely do that. Verderam will most definitely appreciate it.
Local talk plus national headlines from the people who are there. The 2-Minute Drill on the program with Seren Petro on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Joe's Kansas City Barbecue burnt. End of the hour answer. Some burnt ends. Found a burnt ends.
I'm so hungry.
Say
dude.
That I'm going to eat half now and then half for lunch the next day, and then eat half now and half 4 hours from now.
We've been talking about food this entire commercial break, and I'm going to keep doing it after you say the answer to this question.
Mike Garrett, the first Heisman winner to play for the Chiefs. I asked who was the second, and I actually found out that I was off by a week.
Inexcusable.
My answer was going to be Billy Cannon in 1970. He was born on this date. But then looking at the roster of the 1970 Chiefs, I see that John Hewitt, the 1964 winner, quarterback out of Notre Dame, actually played for the Chiefs in week 4 of the 1970 season. Billy Cannon played starting in week 5. So actually the second guy was Hewitt. Cannon next. Chiefs, one of the rare teams in history to have 3 Heisman winners on their team at any one time. Raiders have done it 2 separate times. Did it back in the 80s. I guess it was in 1990 when they had Marcus Allen, Bo Jackson, and Tim Brown. And the Raiders did it again later on with Tim Brown.
Charles Woodson,
and there was one other. I just looked at this a little while ago.
I'm just still reeling from you getting a stat wrong by 1 week. Our boss will be hearing about this.
Yeah, why'd you even bother coming today, Curtis?
I have no idea who the other guy was. The Ravens recently had that with RG3, Lamar Jackson, and Mark Ingram.
I'm scrolling right now to see if I can pinpoint this. Do you know off the top of your head who was the most recent Heisman winner to be on the Chiefs?
Marcus Allen.
Okay, I was just...
He's the only other one. He was there from 93 to 97, I believe.
I was just... My only hesitation for someone more recently was like, okay, now Brady Quinn didn't win it. We have talked about Brady Quinn once today already. Was there some quarterback who, you know, ended up as a backup somewhere? But I'll take your word for it.
The third guy with Tim Brown and Charles Woodson Jett was Desmond Howard.
Ah, yes.
1998, they had Brown, Woodson, and Howard on the team.
How did Vinny Testaverde never end up on a Chiefs roster?
He played on so damn many teams, and as many times as the Chiefs went for the
he would have been
just the veteran guy.
Yeah, it seems like a glitch in the matrix that Vinny Testaverde, with his career, with his journeyman resume,
and the Chiefs' love for strict adherence to the veteran quarterback,
for the ideal journeyman middle of the road quarterback.
It's like, how have you two never met
in the 90s and 2000s? That's exactly it. How did you guys never meet? It really is incredible.
That is kind of something special.
Buccaneers, Browns, Ravens, Jets, Cowboys, Jets, Patriots, Panthers for Vinny Testaverde.
Seemingly played for everyone.
And never landed even in the AFC West.
It's kind of stunning.
It really is. I'm glad we took some time. Glad we took some time to unpack that. The question that is on everybody's mind here on August 2nd, 2021. How did Vinny Testaverde never take a snap for the Chiefs?
The Twitter is what's trending on Twitter.
Yeah, I've been getting bombarded with that question for a while.
Or not at all.
It's actually I've been
sometimes
getting
some of the more interesting things are completely organic, as this clearly was.
Maybe the most interesting thing we'll talk about all day today, which is fun fact. Here's my Joe's into the hour, burn into the hour question here. Did Vinny Testaverde ever play for the Chiefs? 913. No, don't call in. No, don't call Jed. He will not give you any gift cards for
he
getting
will
an
actually
answer.
Take gift cards away from you if you have.
You actually will buy me Joe's.
It's like the Jeopardy loser that was like -7,000 whatever. Like he has to pay that back now to
that
Jeopardy.
Really
I guess so. I don't know. That
I
really
just
happened.
I love that you can be -$7,000 in
awesome.
Jeopardy and you still walk away with a grand.
Yeah, you have to be so bad, right? Like that's
well,
how bad you are.
There is a little bit of bad luck that goes along in it because you can bet up to I think it's $2,000 on the daily double. So if you miss that, then you're kind of down. You know, Blank Creek, a television show Creek.
Yes.
And then it just kind of compounds from there. If you then miss, like, you know, in Double Jeopardy, two $2,000 questions, I mean, it can happen, but you just have to feel like such an idiot. All of the people who your whole life, you should go on Jeopardy.
Like
and
yes.
Then you
Turd
have the
Ferguson.
Worst performance ever.
Ever.
Literally, ever. This no one did worse
than this man.
You
could literally be. I'm forgetting the comic's name now.
Norm MacDonald.
Norm
MacDonald.
As
I know things.
As Burt
I don't
Reynolds.
Think that happened whenever I was a baby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
yeah, you're smart.
I'm smart.
No,
I'm capable.
Yeah. I'm smart.
That one's so over his head. He doesn't.
Do you know that one?
No
you don't,
way.
Do you? You don't know Godfather 2?
No, I have not. You know what, though? I have Godfather 1 on a flash drive to watch. I've made the necessary steps to amend that one, other than actually watching it.
I feel less bad about not watching, having not watched Star Wars.
My girlfriend hadn't seen Godfather, she hasn't seen 3 yet, but when she mentioned that Goodfellas was one of her favorite movies, and I said, oh, well, you love The Godfather then, right, too? Oh, I've never seen that?
What? Interesting.
We are remedying this, and our good friend, Curtis Siebold, gave an accompaniment book that goes along. She's been enjoying looking through.
Yeah, huh. The book, it's called The Annotated Godfather. It's essentially the screenplay with pictures and features and little tidbits about the movie as you go along, deleted scenes.
Interesting.
My friend Gary's 5 years older than I am, and he had not seen The Godfather. So
wow.
That's an interesting movie to see for the 30th time with someone who's not seen it.
Yeah,
you know
it was,
what
it
scenes
really
are coming.
Neat.
You know the horse head scene's coming. You
right.
Know that the scene with McCluskey and Sollozzo are coming.
Don't
you know that the scene...
Or at the beginning with Luca Brasi.
Yeah, you know that the massacre's coming after the you know,
spoiler alert, some of us haven't seen it yet, Chris.
Well, you know what's coming, and you're like, oh, I can't wait to see
it. 30 years ago.
It was like 40.
1972.
Was it really? Holy bleep, I got that wrong also.
Well, one of the things we talked about when the Bucks won their first title in 50 years was that they were like 2 weeks into the shooting of that movie.
Holy smokes.
And it was, you know, basically Al Pacino's breakout role, and they had to convince people that he should be in the movie.
Curtis, this is upsetting. Craig Brenner just texted us, good friend of the program.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's never seen any of the Godfather movies. And Craig Brenner is a movie-watching guy.
Yeah, like,
and
so
I'm
here's...
not a movie-watching guy, which is why there's a lot of movies I have not seen.
So this is...
I watch a small group of movies like 20 times.
There's joy in that. There's something to be had there. Here's where I'm at, and this is probably going to infuriate someone somewhere. I mean, everything you say on the radio infuriates someone somewhere.
But especially if you put it on Twitter.
I'm pissed already.
Last night, on the same flash drive that I have Godfather on, I also had Paddington and Paddington 2, you know, the movie with the little animated bear.
Usually would have grouped those together.
And so I haven't neither Girlfriend or Nair, I had seen either of them.
Is Paddington 2 like a prequel, part prequel and part sequel like Godfather 2 is?
I don't know. I just know that nobody likes Paddington 3.
Paddington became the Don.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Eventually.
But
is there a Fredo Paddington?
I could have
take out.
I could have watched The Godfather last night. And instead, we did watch Paddington 1. And it was charming, and it's got like 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. And Paddington 2 just got its first negative review like a month ago.
I feel fairly confident in saying you're the first person to ever say we could have watched
The Godfather.
Godfather.
Or Paddington.
And instead, we watched Paddington 2.
Paddington 1. Paddington I haven't seen Paddington 1. 2
Kurt,
yet.
Either one.
Out of all of the people who you may not have ever expected to hear that, but coming from Briscoe, are you surprised?
It's not shocking.
Not particularly, actually.
That's a fairly good point. Josh, I think you actually will watch these movies at some point because you just, that's what
you
do.
I like watching movies.
They are kind of longer movies.
Yeah, Paddington was a tight, like, hour and 20, I think.
Yeah, then this would be like 2.5
Paddingtons.
So, Paddington 2 on Rotten Tomatoes has 246 critic reviews and has a 99%. It got its it was at 100% until they found some, like, I think it was like a Spanish language review that had not been added to the system from one of their actual, like, in system. There's literally one.
Wow.
From Eddie Harrison, a real hater, apparently. is the only negative review, I believe, that exists on Rotten Tomatoes among critics for Paddington 2.
Well, and, I mean, if you're...
It answered all the questions from Paddington 1. I mean, what else could
well,
you...
Well, and that's... I think if
Paddington
you
Goes West...
are going into Paddington 2, you know what you're getting yourself into.
Right.
I don't know how in any
it's
way you could
be...
It's
going to be a bloodbath.
Well... I'm really let down.
Paddington was going to bleep and die.
Yeah, I really thought that the drug overdose was coming in this one.
Right. But, like, but for comparison, like I just looked up Cars Rotten Tomatoes, came out in 2006, a largely pretty beloved, critically acclaimed Pixar movie.
Okay.
74% among critics. Something happens in Paddington 2 that just gets everybody. And so I feel the need to watch that.
Years from now, is Paddington 1 going to be actually the fourth?
Yeah,
the
there's a
one.
Whole
and Paddington, the new A New Hope.
So what you're getting into now is, of course, the PCU, and of course you've read up about it. I've written many fan fictions.
How Star Wars.
The Paddington cinematic universe is
right.
going
oh,
to
I
be.
See.
It's going to be an expansive, twisting and turning sort of living document, if you will. just like Star Wars.
I'd like to have seen Quentin Tarantino take on Paddington.
I think we should.
Everything's
get,
out of order.
I think we should get a Quentin Tarantino Paddington. I think that sounds wonderful.
Say Paddington again.
Does he look like a bear? Well, yeah, he's a little bear. I haven't seen that either.
You haven't seen Pulp Fiction?
No. I've seen Paddington 1, though.
You've seen a lot of scenes from it, right?
I'm aware.
You know the scenes?
Yeah, I'm aware of many of the cultural touchstones within.
This has been a very upsetting segment for me for a lot of different regards. I mean, the Paddington bear, bad review, hearing you haven't seen The Godfather, of The Godfathers or Pulp Fiction. And what's sad about that one is because you do just know enough of the references that when you do sit down and watch it, you'll be like, that wasn't that good.
Right, because I kind of know what's coming. Yeah, no, Jed, you really strike me as someone who's trying to escape this segment as if you were in The Shawshank Redemption. I suppose I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen What movies have you seen other than Paddington 1?
I'm going to watch Paddington 2 soon.
Tonight, yeah, probably.
there's no almost telling
you. You haven't gone back and seen the old ones? Do you generally see? Because what I don't do that I wish I always have a commitment every year that I'm going to do this, and I never do.
Yeah.
Is when it gets close to Oscar time. Yeah, I always say, I'm going to do it this year, and then I never do.
Always. I do this also.
One is stop getting soda.
Right.
Lose weight, work out. The other is I'm going to watch the Oscar-nominated movies.
Yes.
And as a general rule, I don't get around to more than one or two of them. Last year, I don't think I saw any that were Oscar nominated.
Legally Acquired. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Haven't watched it yet, but I'm probably going to. That seems interesting. But yeah, I mean, I've gone back and watched some iconic stuff that I've missed that always gets people mad at me. I went back and I watched back to back in the same night The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles.
It's a good flick.
Breakfast Club holds up pretty fun. Kind of like there's some stuff in it that doesn't age super well. No. Tell you what, 16 Candles does not age well at all.
No.
Because I obviously had not seen it at the time.
Not as good,
watching it now through my
Club.
Breakfast Club fun. Breakfast Club fully enjoyed and would watch again.
You realize the completely underrated character that Paul Gleason played as the principal.
Yes.
I mean,
vital.
It's rare that someone who's not one of the core group, that core group of five or whatever it is, and he just steals the movie. With his portrayal.
So that was one of the rewarding returns to a movie that I, you know, am younger than. But what are you gonna go ahead, Jed? Throw some at me. I'll tell you where I'm at.
I mean, this is my own opinion. If you're going to watch a Tarantino movie, out of the two that we've mentioned in this segment, watch Pulp Fiction before you watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's so long and slow and not good.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The problem is Pulp Fiction will take you some putting together. It is completely
call me after you watch it. I'll explain it all.
Just, Jed, can you please explain Pulp Fiction to me?
Yes, I can.
Just to see.
It's a suitcase.
Well,
right?
Just to see, even, I think, of all the great scenes by Samuel L. Jackson in that movie, the one that gets the least credit is the most deserving of additional credit is the diner scene at the end.
Okay, I don't think I have a reference point for that.
I think he should have won an Oscar just for the speech that he tells Ringo.
Okay, so that right there, that is something that I think you're right with it being underrated, because I don't know what you're talking about.
You will like.
I like that.
And you get to see John Travolta fire heroin, so that's always good. Not, I don't think he really did it, but.
I mean, this is reckless speculation, but if you had to guess if John Travolta has ever, as you said, fired heroin.
I would say probably has not.
Is fired heroin a verb? Is that a heroin verb that I didn't know about?
Jed knows all the terminology.
Yeah. I'm learning so much.
I mean, I don't use heroin, but I've heard
it. I didn't
it.
Mean to imply that you had if
Thank
I did.
You.
I don't believe that Jed uses heroin, just so everyone's clear. I think it's a unanimous 3-0 vote here. I'm Googling John Travolta heroin, and then we can take a break, but I feel like I need to land this plane. Did research with heroin addicts.
And in case you can't tell, Soren Petro is on vacation.
Oh, he talk about heroin, right?
A moment. When you're talking sports with guys, you stop for a second and talk about him.
It was a four-hour show, and it's been we've been good today, Jay.
And you are very hungry, so it's more the hunger that's gotten us off course here.
We were either going to talk about movies or food this segment because I'm hungry for one of those two things, and the alternative is, you know, how do you guys think Brad Keller is going to bounce back?
Yeah. who flashed at training of day four of training?
Who looked good? Who looked good today?
Oh, man. You know, I'm starting to worry about Noah Gray and also Brad Keller. And then they throw it a brick. And it's like, oh, yes, we did the thing. And instead, we talked about, you know, we got people mad at me for movies I haven't seen, which is really, I think, sorry, baseball. I think that's actually America's pastime.
The program with Soren Petro.
What do you think is coursing through my veins right now?
Cheese Whiz.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
I just thought we were doing. That was Curtis for the record.
That's not Rage Against the Machine. That is Audio Slave. Members of Rage Against the Machine. I like Audio Slave too. You could just let it play out.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I didn't know that they. Which one came first? Rage, right?
Rage Against the Machine.
Okay.
And Chris Cornell was the frontman of Soundgarden. They're all kind of that same early 90s. And Curtis is just sad all day.
It's been a very musical episode of the program. I'm not Soren Petro, but it wouldn't matter if I was. We'll take a break. More program.
Talk sports next hour.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. Some audio next.
It's the Jazz End of the Hour Question on the Half Shell. Sponsored by Jazz, a Louisiana kitchen.
Laissez le bon temps rouler.
All right, who's the Red Sox career leader in innings pitched? Brought to you by Jazz, a Louisiana kitchen.